This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Joe Biden has been inaugurated as President of the United States of America. This is not what we at the Trumpet were expecting based on the prophecies that we're looking at, but all the events of this past week did not change the facts of what occurred on November 3rd and the days afterward, and it didn't change the prophecies. As far as we know, those are still going to happen as we expect, which means that this nation is still in for some dramatic revelations. At the beginning of today's program, we're going to talk about some of that, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. What has already started to change, however, is the political picture in America, dramatically so, as the Biden administration has taken power and immediately and aggressively begun undoing the work of the Trump administration. And when you look back to what Mr. Fleury has been writing about that spirit of Antiochus and just how destructive to America it is, he's been talking about that at least since the first days of the Obama administration 12 years ago, and even before that, at least since Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats came to power in 2017. Everything that he wrote in America Under Attack and Great Again is roaring back into focus. And then, of course, all that he said about the role that President Trump played in putting a check on those forces, about God using a Jeroboam administration as a tool for saving America temporarily. That, too, is stunningly clear to see, because now that this man is out of office, we're seeing a hard return to the Obama era in American policy. And really, it's even worse than it was when Obama was in power, because the Democrat Party has moved so much further left than it was even 4 years ago. And President Biden is very much on board with that in a way that he has never been throughout his over 40 years in politics. We're going to look at some of the domestic policies that he's already enacting. We'll look at the effect that this will have on America's foreign policy and on the actions of other nations toward America and in the world generally. We're going to start, though, by just looking at the inauguration itself and its immediate aftermath. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, really what we're looking at here is the greatest heist in world history. Like I said, on Wednesday, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were sworn in, surrounded by 25,000 National Guardsmen, and what has to have been the most unusual inauguration ceremony in American history. I mean, you saw some of the news footage leading up and the preparation for the inauguration, and the whole panorama almost looked like something from a third world country under martial law, as they had to evacuate one of the rehearsals due to a dumpster fire in a homeless encampment. You saw helicopters flying overhead, military vehicles patrolling the streets, your guardsmen stopping people and checking their identities at checkpoints, in addition to just the psychological presence of 25,000 National Guardsmen. That's definitely more security than if they've ever had an American inauguration. And that number, 25,000, that's 10 times more than you have soldiers fighting terrorism in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
I think... So yeah, huge military presence, as they're just really concerned that something was going to break out, some violence or protest were going to break out at this inauguration, and that concern was somewhat justified, and that, like I said, this is the biggest heist in American history. There's been all sorts of evidence of the irregularities and the election fraud in this election. Probably one of the better sources is a report from Dr. Peter Navarro. He has like three volumes of a report just going through the types of electoral fraud we're looking at here, And in his analysis, he said he hasn't been able to locate one silver bullet that stole the election, but it was more a death by 1,000 cuts between people who voted twice and people under 18 who voted and illegal immigrants who voted and people who are dead who voted, or digital election spikes where just like all of a sudden the computers, like 100,000 voters appeared out of nowhere in an instant. And in his report, which is really thorough, he's identified 3,069,002 possibly illegal votes. Those are either votes that are clearly fraudulent or highly suspect. And that's just in the six swing states of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Now, Mr. Biden's margin of victory in those swing states was only a tenth of that, about a little over 300,000 votes. So, yeah, so basically his point is, like he said, the margin of error in this election is 10 times greater than the margin of victory. So no reasonable person can assume this election was free and fair. And it looks like probably Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, most of all, know that this election wasn't free and fair, thus the need for helicopters and 25,000 troops and all these guardsmen to make sure that they stay safe as they go through the final stages of this heist.
Well, all of this information, there is a whole lot of it out there, and I guess the stunning thing about it is just how effectively it has been shut down and silenced by big media, big tech, by the political class, by even the Republican establishment. They are just not interested in this information at all. Gerald Flory wrote in that article why Donald Trump will remain America's president, about just how there are going to be some, you know, big frauds exposed. In a lot of ways, the information has emerged that shows a tremendous amount of fraud, but it's just not having an impact because of the blunting effect that this suppression of information on the part of these powerful entities within America is having. What I think is probably the most stunning and alarming of all the developments that we're seeing, in my view, is just how aggressively the Democrats are coming after this type of information, the source of anyone who would disseminate this or believe this, anyone who supports Donald Trump. They're talking about effectively dismantling the Republican Party. They're branding anyone who even questions what happened in the last election an insurrectionist or a terrorist. This is a huge development for America and even for organizations like ours who depend on freedom of religion and freedom of speech. You know, if the Biden administration were to continue, then organizations like ours would not be able to function. Richard, you had a comment.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you guys are being pretty brave. I'm a bit safer over here in England, a bit more removed from American authorities. But if you believe what some on the left are saying, then you and Andrew are basically terrorists.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what they're saying. If you question the election, you know, there's kind of this warped logic whereby what happened with storming the cap, or not storming, but those people trespassing in the Capitol building. You know, that was a terrorist attack that was motivated by people talking about election fraud. Therefore, if you talk about election fraud, you are a terrorist. Of course, those people that entered the same building, or the Senate, I think it was, when the confirmation of Kavanaugh was going on, that's entirely different. People that pushed this idea that Brett Kavanaugh was a sex offender or something with no evidence, they're not terrorists, but Republicans are. And so, you know, you've got John Brennan on TV saying that he's heard from the Biden team that they're, quote, moving in a laser-like fashion to uncover as much as they can. And their target, he says, are religious extremists, authoritarians, fascists, bigots, racists, nativists, even libertarians. So if you just believe the government shouldn't be taking quite so much of your money in taxes, you are a potential terrorist, and the Biden administration might be coming after you. That is what John Brennan is saying. And you can see all across these different experts and media now, you're getting this from all sides. You know, you're having Katie Couric talk about, well, how do we deprogram Trump supporters. You had that lawyer, I think that was shortly before the inauguration, on PBS talking about, well, we need to be taking the kids away from Trump supporters so that we can re-educate them.
Yeah, reprogram is the term that we're hearing now. We need to be reprogrammed.
Yeah. I guess they've cottoned on to the fact that re-education camps have a bit of a negative history, and maybe if they call them reprogramming camps, they somehow sound friendly.
Yeah, that sounds much nicer. Yeah, reprogramming.
You're gonna learn some computer skills there, guys.
Wow.
I mean, you had CNN with a cult expert on talking about the, 70 million plus people who voted for President Trump. They're part of a cult. A law professor, Professor Loretta Ross, basically saying, the Republican Party is just like the Nazi Party, and we're in 1945. That's the comparison she's making, that just like the Nazi Party was made illegal after 1945 and there were the Nuremberg trials to prosecute its leaders, well, that's what needs to happen right now to the Republican Party. They should not be allowed to hold office, stand for election. We should be locking people up. And then, of course, you've got the extension of this point of view in the tech media to the point that all this week we've not been able to broadcast on YouTube.
Yeah.
We typically have our program, our daily program, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, going out on YouTube. We're blocked from that. And at one point in time, you'd have thought maybe you could go to the government to get redress from that kind of thing. What was it? Microsoft was found billions for illegally using their monopoly power to force people to use a certain web browser. Now, YouTube can use their monopoly power to decide what views are and aren't allowed to be heard. And the government is actually the one encouraging that and saying, well, we're going to go even further. And actually, maybe we'll go around and lock up the people that YouTube are banning. I mean, we've made this point before, but we've had Mr. Gerald Flurry saying for years, the left want to stamp out free speech and overturn the American constitutional republic. And maybe the first time you heard that, it was a bit shocking or surprising. And that's exactly what has happened. We're, 2-3 days into this, since this inauguration? And it's a case of, if you disagree with us, we want to stamp you out and shut you up.
So, Andrew, let's talk about the domestic policies we're already starting to see enacted. President Biden got right to work from day one.
Yeah, he's trying to dismantle President Trump's legacy faster than any incoming president has tried to dismantle his predecessor's legacy. There's almost too much to talk about, so I'll try to focus on the 17 executive orders, just give a quick rundown that he enacted on his first afternoon, that like he did on Wednesday after he was inaugurated. Probably the one that's made me the most personally sad was he instantly deleted the 1776 project. That was, you've heard of the 1619 project that the New York Times is doing about how America was founded on slavery. Well, the 1776 project is a 45-page document that the Trump administration commissioned to show that America was actually, its defining feature was not slavery, which was common throughout many nations, but freedom. And Joe Biden, he deleted that like almost instantaneously after being elected president. I did get a copy, a bootleg copy that I've got on my coffee table at home that I can show you later if you promise not to turn me into the thought police. But it's
I promise.
But that's the one that made me the most personally sad. But the other one, just giving a quick rundown, is Mr. Biden signed an executive order appointing Jeffrey Zients as the official COVID-19 response coordinator. He signed an executive order requiring social distancing and the wearing of masks on all federal property. He signed an executive order reinstating ties with the World Trade Organization after the Trump administration had chose to withdraw America's membership, and made Dr. Anthony Fauci the head of the U.S. delegation to the World Trade Organization. So we'll probably be hearing more from him. He signed an executive order basically reinstating the deferred action for childhood arrivals, meaning that any illegal immigrant who arrived here as a child is now not going to be deported. He revoked an executive order that the Trump administration put in place excluding non-citizens from the census count. That order was designed to be like, you can't count illegal immigrants in California for the purpose of determining how many representatives they get in the House of Representatives, since they can't vote. And he did away with that. He's like, the illegal immigrants, they still can't vote, but they count in the census to make sure that California gets as much electoral votes as
right.
possible.
Yeah.
He signed one ending the so-called Muslim ban, which blocked travel to the United States from several Middle Eastern and African countries with terrorist problems. He signed an executive order halting the construction of the border wall with Mexico. That was President Trump's probably most famous campaign promise, is to build the wall. So that's now that project's been frozen. He signed an executive order re-putting the United States into the Paris Climate Accords. He signed an executive order canceling the Keystone Pipeline, bringing oil from Canada down to ports on the Gulf of Mexico. Even Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's not famous as a bastion of conservative values, protested that was a little extreme.
Uh-huh.
But he signed another executive order revoking President Trump's executive order limiting the ability of federal agencies, contractors, and other institutions to hold diversity and inclusive training. So basically he wants more diversity training in the federal government. All right, I'll skip a few of these 17 since looks like we're getting running out of time. But the last one is finally Mr. Biden issued a freeze on all of President Trump's previous executive orders until he actually has the time to go through them to see if they need to be revoked as well.
Well, I'd like to start talking about just the effects on foreign policy. We'll start with the Biden administration's move to transform America's policy toward Israel and Iran. For this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it didn't take long. On Inauguration Day, there was already a change that was made to the official Twitter account of the ambassador to Israel. That was David Friedman. He left his post, and then immediately there was a screenshot that was grabbed of that because it's since changed back after all the blowback that it received from, or that the United States newer government received from Israel. It was no longer the United States ambassador to Israel. It was the United States ambassador to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. This is the official Twitter account of the U.S. ambassador to Israel, West Bank, and Gaza. Previously, even under Obama, it was just the U.S. ambassador to Israel, and then certainly he would be concerned with Palestinian affairs as well. And yet, although a lot of Israelis are asking, well, why this change? Why this immediate change to something so insignificant as a Twitter handle or a Twitter bio? Does it announce that the United States is going to pursue more of a policy that was Obama-esque, where you'll remember the parting shot of the Obama administration against Israel, who was an overtly anti-Israel administration, was resolution 2334, which it vetoed. Samantha Power, she vetoed, or did not veto, refused to veto that, which basically said that Israelis inside the West Bank, East Jerusalem, are illegal occupants. That is not Israeli territory. And this normally Israel or the United States would veto such a resolution at the Security Council, but Samantha Power decided not to do that. And there was rapturous applause. I think people remember that. And so that's what Israelis are wondering right now. Are we starting off with this Biden administration seeing a lot of the same names that were there under Obama, including Samantha Power? She's back also. Are we starting off from that where it left off back then, declaring that the West Bank and Gaza are definitely not going to be Israeli territory, but Israel is illegally occupying those spaces?
You could certainly see where this would cause quite a lot of anxiety in Israel. Losing the support of the Trump administration and being more isolated. In some ways, they took full advantage of that time when President Trump was in office and to make those deals with some of their Arab neighbors, and maybe they were kind of bracing themselves for this moment. The big news from what's happening now with the Biden administration in place relates to its dealings with Iran.
Right. And there were reports that appeared in a French paper today and also Jerusalem Post that negotiations are already and have been underway for the past 3 weeks between the Biden administration and Iran, speaking about a return to the Iran nuclear deal, perhaps under slightly different terms, but nevertheless, the newspaper Le Figaro was speaking to somebody, a close source of this, and said that they expected that a return to the deal could be negotiated very quickly and that we would find out very soon that the United States has bought back into this. Now, this isn't surprising, even looking at some of the personnel that Mr. Biden has brought into power or a part of his administration. You had William Burns, who's the new director of the CIA, Jake Sullivan, who is the new national security advisor. These were two critical people involved in the very beginning of the Iran nuclear deal. Back in 2012, 2013, they were the ones having covert dealings with the Iranians in Oman that were setting up this potential deal between Iran and the United States under President Obama. They're back. And then it looks like there is going to be nominated to Iran's the special envoy to Iran, that Robert Malley, who was the Middle East advisor to President Obama back in 2014. Robert Malley might actually be the one that heads up this outreach from the United States to Iran. And he is an anti-Semite, and everybody knows that he is. He's actually had meetings with Hamas. He was actually stopped advising the Obama administration or his campaign back in 2008 because of his ties to Hamas, or his ties to the leadership in Hamas and the meetings that he had had. And so Obama said, we'll just stand back for a while. Then in 2014, O'Malley was actually brought back into the fold, being a special Middle Eastern advisor. And it looks like he's going to be tapped by Joe Biden as being the special envoy for Iran as well. And so there's probably three or four other key people that were there. Wendy Sherman, who negotiated the nuclear deal for underneath Kerry. She's back. Kerry's back also. Now, they're each fulfilling different roles in this administration. However, if you look back to their key foreign policy signature deal, it was the Iran deal. And so they've all got a special place in their heart for this deal that they negotiated, that they've said was a successful negotiation. And so to come back, for them to all come back and expect us to see a far stronger deal or a better deal, they would have to go against what they've said, saying that it was the best deal that they could have gotten. So there's not a great chance of that happening.
Well, we were talking, I think it was just last week, about how Iran is already putting itself in a position to enrich uranium. It's just weeks away from nuclear breakout in light of a Biden administration. Now that you have the administration in place and it's already making these overtures to try to bring Iran back to renegotiate. Gerald Fleury was talking about how the initial Iran deal was the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. That was the title of the article that he wrote at the time. It looks like it could actually be surpassed by an even bigger blunder.
Yeah, I think Iran is already knows that the United States is desperate for this deal. And I wouldn't be surprised if already Iran is breaking it's the sanctions that the U.S. has put on it, whether they're not tempting the Biden administration to act, selling a bunches of oil to China. They've probably already started that because they don't fear a Biden administration. Also, they've said that they're going to expect damages from the United States. If there's any negotiation, before we start, quit all the sanctions you've got on us. And then how about you pay us back for all the money we lost when your president, Donald Trump, left the deal? This is billions and billions and billions of dollars. They're going to ask for an upfront check that'll be paid by American taxpayers. To use for what? Well, to use for the same reason they used the $150 billion plus the $1.8 billion in cash that was sent there as a ransom payment for the Americans that were there. It was funneled into the IRGC, not funneled into the economy of Iran. It was funneled into further dangerous terrorist actions across the Middle East and to actually funneled into their nuclear program as well.
Well, yeah, and as horrifying as it is to contemplate some kind of an arrangement like that, it's just you just cannot put anything past this administration that's taking power. Well, we will link to that worst foreign policy blunder article in the show notes, and we appreciate that, Brent. Now a look at how a Biden administration will alter America's relations with Europe. For this, we'll go back to Richard.
Yeah, I think this is just... Oh, there's one aspect of this is especially fascinating. I mean, we've been talking for months about how Europe has been salivating at the prospect of a Biden administration. They are, they like him much better than President Trump. But I'd like to focus today on one concrete thing that we're already seeing happen. And Brent was talking about this disastrous deal that emerged under Mr. Obama that we're seeing come back. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory drew attention to another disastrous deal, not quite as disastrous as the Iran deal, but another deal. There's a whole chapter in the Great Again booklet that talks about it, that President Obama made, that President Trump did a lot to unmake. And again, just within days of this administration, we're seeing Europe pushing for a change in this deal. And that is America's deal with Cuba. So the EU, they're putting forward a statement. They're saying they reject, or that they've long rejected, the United States' trade embargo on Cuba. And they are wanting America to lift the sanctions that Mr. Trump put on Cuba. They want to end the designation of Cuba as a terrorist sponsor, which Mr. Trump put in place. They want their companies to be much freer to go and do business with Cuba. And the EU Observer wrote about this. The EU Observer, they are pretty pro the EU, and they themselves made clear that they wanted this this embargo to be lifted. At the same time, that same article contained a lot of evidence that they were quoting from a Czech non-governmental organization that lifting this embargo is just going to help the dictatorial government there. This NGO said that any EU aid and tourist spending would just help Cuba's feared state security department, which focuses on suppressing dissent and so-called ideological subversion. So doing this would just prop up an evil dictatorial regime in Cuba, but Europe is pushing for it anyway. And, you know, it would be absolutely consistent for this administration just to follow down exactly what Mr. Obama did in his term. So here, Mr. Flory really drew attention to this deal. The chapter in Great Again is called The Deadly Deal with Cuba. And he talks about just how important Cuba is for America's security, how dangerous it would be for a foreign power to really start to get a foothold there, how much the Pope pushed for Mr. Obama to have this deal with Cuba. Now you're seeing Europe to push for another deal with Cuba and another opportunity for them to move in there, right in this underbelly of the United States, and an island that's just crucial for controlling America's trade with the world, really.
Mm-hmm. Very important aspect to focus on what's happening there with Cuba. I'd like to just take a moment. Andrew, you had a story just about the Pope's response to the Biden administration. There were some Catholics who are looking at Joe Biden basically as a bad Catholic, coming out and criticizing the Pope. Put the kibosh on that.
Yeah, this is interesting. Richard just mentioned the Pope, and he made a really interesting move this week. Is that normally the U.S. Bishops' Conference always publishes a letter when a new president comes in, praising what they like about him and criticizing what they don't. When President Trump came in, they mainly criticized his economic policies and his immigration policies, but praised his policies on abortion. Now, with Biden coming in, they love his economic policies and they love his immigration policies. Mm-hmm. But the Bishops' Conference had prepared a pretty letter criticizing him over his policies on abortion, contraception, marriage, and gender. That statement read, "Of deep concern is the liberty of the church and the freedom of believers to live according to their conscience." And so they really said that there was a lot of moral evils in regards to abortion, homosexual marriage, transgenderism that the Biden administration was trying to force on Americans. And they're getting ready to publish this letter when the Vatican Secretary of State stepped in and told them not to do it. And so obviously the Vatican Secretary of State, that's a Vatican office, it's a Vatican cabinet level position right under the Pope. They wouldn't do that without the Pope's approval. And so Pope Francis is stepping in to make sure that you do not criticize the Biden's administration's policies on abortion, contraception, and gender. And you're like, well, why would he do that? And I think one of the really most succinct comments I've read on that, it comes from an email that the British economist Rodney Atkinson had sent to the late Trump writer Ron Fraser, that said the defining characteristics of the Roman Catholic Church is not religion, but imperial politics. Obviously, the Catholic Church has doctrines, and doctrines they force on people when they have the power. But those historically have always taken a backseat to its imperial ambitions. And right now, the Vatican's imperial ambitions are to empower a Biden administration to tear down what President Trump has done, because they do not want a powerful United States as the world's superpower.
Mm. So, Richard, what's your view of what we can expect, say, from Europe, and particularly relations between Europe and America now that Joe Biden has taken over the White House?
A push for independence for Europe and a strong, muscular European foreign policy. There's lots of people saying, well, we've got to continue. You know, President Trump was trying to push us to be independent, and we couldn't rely on him. Even now that Joe Biden's back in the White House, we need to continue down this path. I think one thing that's fascinating, just this week, the leader of the Green Party's think tank co-authored an article calling for Germany's military to become stronger, up to 2%, and for Germany to continue to host nuclear weapons. You know, opposition to nuclear weapons is the entire reason for the existence of a Green Party. But now they're okay with it. And it was no coincidence it was coming in the same week as President Biden. And again, even the Green Party pushing for more military. They're typically the anti-military party within Germany. So you're seeing an increased support within Europe for them to come together to take on more responsibility and more power in this world. And all of these points tie into different prophecies that we've been talking about. This one especially, we have a trends article, Europe Militarizes, or the article's title, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military, where all of these Bible prophecies that talk about this modern European power, they talk about it being a military power, and obviously a power very independent from the United States. And that's exactly the direction we see Europe getting ready to go in.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll take one more look at how a Biden administration will affect foreign policy for America and its effect on Asia. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, I'd like to start with China. We've heard from Andrew about just how eager President Biden is to roll back pretty much every major foreign policy initiative that the Trump administration implemented. But when it comes to China, Biden has actually said that he is in no rush to depart from Trump administration policies. There are no orders on the table to rescind the $350 billion worth of tariffs that Trump placed on Chinese imports. There are no plans about overturning Trump's decision to delist Chinese telecommunication companies on the New York Stock Exchange, or the decision about blacklisting other Chinese companies. His administration also said this week that they agree with the Trump administration's decision earlier in the week to label China's actions against Uyghur Muslims as genocide and to ban all the cotton that's picked in that area, just because so much of it comes from forced labor. So some of this sounds not too terrible, but I'd like to play a clip here from Mr. Biden. This is from several months back when he was campaigning for America's presidency, and here it is.
China is going to eat our lunch? Come on, man. They can't figure out how they're going to deal with the corruption that exists within the system. I mean, they're not bad folks, but guess what? They're not competition for us.
So that was Joseph Biden revealing what is, I think, his true view of China. You know, he's ridiculing statements and policies from President Trump there. He's showing, I think, that he's either just woefully naive about China's ambition and its power, or that he's perhaps beholden to the Chinese. And we know that there have been some alarming accusations about Biden and his family. His son, Hunter Biden, has a 10% stake and a position as one of the 9 directors of a major Chinese private equity firm. There are also accounts of the Biden family receiving just millions of dollars from the Chinese for positions such as that one, and from all kinds of other shady business dealings with China. So it is likely that Mr. Biden is beholden in some alarming ways. And I think that clip shows that despite what we may be hearing from President Biden right now, he's compromised when it comes to China. And we should not expect him to deal with the Chinese in a way that will protect America.
It really is remarkable in the time since the inauguration how completely all of these concerns about Joseph Biden and his family's ties to China have been completely swept under the rug. I mean, you go back and you look at some of those revelations, and particularly the one that stands out to me is the statement from that that Chinese professor who talked about having friends in high places in Washington and how they were unable to affect policy in Washington for 4 years. We need to get these people back into office. Now, here we are again, and no one is talking about that at all. But that is a genuine concern.
It really is, yes. And I think probably the Chinese are just overjoyed to have, you know, powerful people back in high places under the Biden administration that are beholden to them and that they can control in some alarming ways. And then we also have some indications of what the Biden administration's Russia policies will be. He's appointed Avril Haines as his intelligence chief. She's talked about taking a harder line on Russia than the Trump administration did. You know, President Trump actually never criticized Russian President Vladimir Putin for the poisoning or arrest of Alexei Navalny, the SolarWinds hack, some other things like that. And the Biden administration says that it will be opening investigations into all those things. The polls show that 65% of Democrats view Russia as a major threat, while only 35% of Republicans do. And I think that's one area where the Trump would actually be more in line with the 65% there, just because of Bible prophecy. Prophecy actually says that Russia and China will form an immensely powerful military alliance with other Asian nations that will play a major role in besieging America and Britain, and in going on from there to play just a major role in a nuclear World War III. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that it will be Russia and not China that will lead that block. And, you know, Putin's track record already shows that he is absolutely ruthless about amassing power and neutralizing opposition. So hearing this talk from Biden about a hard stance on Russia could be viewed as somewhat reassuring, but I also think that we shouldn't be deceived by those kinds of statements.
Right.
We should remember that when President Obama was in office, he was actually caught on mic talking to, you know, he thought the microphone was off, but it was left on. He was talking to the Russian prime minister, and he said that he would have, quote, more flexibility to basically capitulate to Russia once he had been reelected for his second term. And that, I think, gives us insight into the kind of view that Biden secretly has, the same view that President Obama had toward Russia. So as with China, I think there's a lot of dangerous, really, refusal to truly confront Russia in a meaningful way.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely the case. When you look at the actual policies, not just the talk, but the policies that America had under the Obama administration versus the Trump administration, that the Trump administration was much tougher against Russia than Obama ever was. And there was a, the 65% of Democrats that are saying that Russia is the bigger threat, this is after having been fed this propaganda essentially for 4 years that Russia was trying the biggest, what compromised American democracy more than any other foreign actor, that it was all about Russia all that time. But they really have not looked at Vladimir Putin, the actions that he's taking within the Asian sphere, and what he's doing to increase Russia's military power and its ability to reconstruct the Soviet Empire. They're concerned about these kinds of the effects that it's having on our country without looking at the real threat, the way that, say, the Eastern European countries are. And the idea that President Biden would be tougher on Russia and prevent those things from taking place really is a fantasy. Well, we appreciate that. We will link to several of the articles that we talked about in this segment in the show notes. We're going to take a little bit of a break now. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll have more international news, what's happening in the rest of the world as all of this is happening in Washington, including news out of Africa, specifically Sudan and Ethiopia, and Germany and Russia and Turkey. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We will travel over to Africa now, where tensions between Ethiopia and Sudan are escalating. To learn about this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, Ethiopia and Sudan have started a small conflict on the border of their two countries. This is something that's been ongoing for about 2 weeks now. It really did start because Sudan encroached upon territory that they belong as theirs with a military incursion soon after that Ethiopia started to fight against the Tigrayans in northern Ethiopia. We've talked about this civil war that's going on right now in northern Ethiopia with the Tigrayan people that used to rule over all of Ethiopia up until a couple of years ago. The first stage of that has taken place, and the Ethiopians have declared themselves successful in that. However, there's still fighting and still a massive humanitarian disaster taking place inside of Ethiopia. And so just on the border of the Tigrayan region is Ethiopia to the east, and is Sudan to the east. And it seems that Sudan has made the most of the distracted Ethiopian fighting forces and taking back this farmland, which they believe belongs to them. Now, Ethiopia has in turn started to fly its jets over this territory. It started to hit Sudani troops. There's been scores killed on either side of this. And Egypt now looks like it might be getting involved, not necessarily militarily, but definitely supporting Sudan in its claim to this part of the border that has always been theirs. But Sudan has allowed Ethiopian farmers to work these lands. However, Sudan has taken that back.
It's been a while since we talked about this. This has actually been brewing for quite a while, and we talked about it on programs a month or two ago. But the fact that you see this this intervention on the part of outside forces, we've been talking about just the fact that this is not a localized issue when you look at it, especially in light of Bible prophecy, that we expect this to blow up into a bigger issue, and we're already kind of seeing some of that.
Yeah, if you look at all the nations that are bordering Ethiopia to its east, north, and west, even Somalia, Eritrea, and now Sudan, each of those nations have had fighting forces in Ethiopian territory in the past 2 weeks. So Somalis have been used as cannon fodder by the Eritrean government as Eritrea comes to support Ethiopia against this breakaway northern province of Tigray. And now you have Sudan being involved. And Sudan, of course, is really the key factor at whether Ethiopia is going to be successful against the Tigrayans, because that's the way that the supply lines for Tigray comes through Sudan. And so Sudan was the gatekeeper to cutting off all aid and equipment that the Tigrayan region could get. So Sudan recognizes that it does hold so a lot of cards over Ethiopia right now, and it makes sense for it to try and, you know, serve its self-interest. However, looking in terms of biblical prophecy at this whole region, we did expect going back 2 months ago when this conflict began that violence between Tigray and Ethiopia would start to engulf the whole Horn of Africa region. Biblical prophecy talks about, based on a prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, that this area of Ethiopia and towards the north, all the way up towards north, towards Egypt, is going to come under the hold of radical Islam, particularly led by Iran. And so while we haven't seen too much Iranian influence or outside influence from Iran inside this conflict in Ethiopia, we did say that Iran is very good at maximizing destabilized areas, especially with large Muslim populations. Ethiopia is one of those. Of course, Eritrea and Sudan are heavily Muslim populations as well. And so we are watching for, as this gets more and more out of hand and more countries get involved, for Egypt to get more involved as well, because that nation is destined to ally with Iran, but also for Iranian influence and Islamist influences to increase there in the country and of Ethiopia. If people want to read more about this, they can read Mr. Gerald Flory's book, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy.
Thank you for that, Brent. Now, a couple of stories about the nation of Turkey, a notable snub to Turkey from Russia this week, and signs of a thaw in the nation's relationship with Germany. We'll start with the second of those. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, on January 18th, the German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas visited Turkey, where he kind of openly went there with the hope of improving relations between the two. And the Deutsche Welle talked about how frosty some of the discussions between Turkey and Europe have been recently. And he was traveling there to try and turn it around. He met with his Turkish counterpart and the Turkish foreign minister. He talked about the positive atmosphere that the talks took place in. Heiko Maas said that they were very complicated issues, but not unsolvable. And I think what you've got here is the Bible has some very specific prophecies about the role that Turkey is going to play. And this is an example of an area where you go back not even that long. The Bible says that Turkey is going to be allied with Europe. We'll have an article that goes through more of that information, but the book of Obadiah is an article all about Turkey, and there's much more in there as well. But it talks about them having this alliance with Europe, working with Europe to turn against Israel, Britain, America, Israel in the Middle East. And so, they're prophesied to be allied with Europe. But they've been moving closer to Russia. Tensions between Turkey and Europe were getting pretty high. France was even talking about backing Greece in kind of military action against Turkey. And it looked like things were moving in the opposite direction to Bible prophecy. Now, throughout all of that and those tensions that we've seen over the past few months, Germany still was the kind of restraining power on Europe, saying, calm down. We want to have good relations with Turkey. They have the key to the Middle East. They can turn on the tap to all the migrants coming up into Europe. We want to be nice to them. And then now you're seeing Germany leading the way, going over with their foreign minister going to Turkey, really working to bring Turkey round as an ally. And we wrote an article, it's called Pivotal Power, that talks from our 2017 Trumpet edition, that talks about the role Turkey plays in Bible prophecy. And back then, again, Turkey was moving much closer into the Russian orbit, and people were saying that that was going to be the next big alliance, was the Turkey-Russian alliance. Now we're seeing things that go back, and we're seeing the relationship much more resemble exactly what was forecast in the Bible.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. We will link to that as well as an article that we have, The Signs of German-Turkish Rapprochement, that's also at thetrumpet.com. That'll be in the show notes for today's program. While relations with Germany look like they may be thawing, Turkey received a notable blow from Russia this week. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about a meeting that just took place in Moscow between Russian President Vladimir Putin and the presidents of Armenia and Azerbaijan. But before we get there, it's important to know that Armenia and Azerbaijan, really most of the Caucasus, were historically dominated by Russia. These nations were actually part of the Soviet Union. But after the USSR's collapse, the countries became independent and several challenges started to arise against Russian power over them. And one of these big challenges was the spread of Turkish influence in that area, and especially in Azerbaijan. So now let's fast forward to the last couple of months of last year. There was a big conflict there between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which we've spoken about on the show several times. And Azerbaijan won control over the area that they were fighting over. And that victory happened with quite a bit of Turkish support. So that indicated that Turkey's position in the region would grow even stronger. But Vladimir Putin also played a big role in that conflict and in brokering the ceasefire. And he doesn't want Turkey's position in the Caucasus strengthened. So at this meeting that happened in Moscow just a few days ago, Turkey was very noticeably absent. The Turks were not invited. They weren't even mentioned in the big press release that was published after the meeting. And this, it infuriated Turkey because they had expended a lot to help bring an end to the conflict. They wanted a place at the table for these kinds of post-war talks. And then it's also very significant that what they discussed at the meeting was mainly building infrastructure and transport links in the Caucasus. They started planning new land routes from Armenia to Russia. They started the process to revive several of the old Soviet-era rail links as well. Some of these would even go into Georgia and Iran. So, you know, Russia had already been able to move thousands of troops into the Caucasus because of this war last year, and now it's making some big plans about building the infrastructure to better connect Russia to the region. And it's doing it all in a way that totally crowds Turkey out. And of course, you know, as I said, the Caucasus nations used to be Soviet states under Moscow's control, and we know that Putin's been doing all he can to return as many of the former Soviet states to his control as he can. So this situation with sidelining Turkey and just dramatically improving Russia's position in the area, that shows that Putin is on course to make this very important region an exclusively Russian domain of influence once again. And that is it should be viewed as a major victory for Putin.
It seems that Turkey being excluded the way that it was probably the most notable example that of what Russia did to other nations. It wasn't the only nation that was snubbed here.
That's true, yes. Back in the 1990s, shortly after the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a multilateral group formed specifically to deal with Nagorno-Karabakh. That's the territory that both Armenia and Azerbaijan claim. And that's what this whole war last year was over. But when this multilateral group was formed to lead all the settlement efforts, it was made up of not just Russia and Turkey, but also the United States and France. So really, the U.S. and France should have been involved in helping end this war and broker the peace and all the post-war meetings and all that, and in deciding who will build infrastructure and concerns like that. It was supposed to be all four of them, plus the actual nations involved. But Putin has so successfully diminished the role of America and France over the years in that region that no one was really even surprised that neither of them were represented at this important meeting. So really that shows, it shows in itself just how powerful Russia is becoming in this area.
So continued evidence rising of Vladimir Putin's success in restoring Russia's control over these former Soviet territories. From the standpoint of Bible prophecy, how do you view that success?
Yeah, well, you know, we watch these kinds of things at the Trumpet very closely because of what Bible prophecy says about Putin's role in end time events. We spoke earlier about this colossal Asian bloc that will be very powerful in the modern era. And there's a passage in Ezekiel 38 that gets very specific about which countries will be in this bloc and the fact that Russia will lead it and that one individual in Russia will actually be at the helm of this whole bloc. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has identified Vladimir Putin as this individual. And he's written a whole book about this. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And I think all of that shows that when we see Putin asserting Russia's will in neighboring states such as Armenia and Azerbaijan and blocking countries like Turkey out, all of that helps us see just how effectively this man will be able to lead this confederation of Asian nations, and it shows just how relevant these scriptures are.
Well, thank you very much for that. The Prophesied Prince of Russia is the name of the booklet that explains those prophecies. We also have an article that will be appearing soon on thetrumpet.com about this situation with Azerbaijan and Armenia. Watch for that on the website. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Napoleon Hill: victory is always possible for the person who refuses to stop fighting. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.